my guys are still under a judicial estrangement order. That blue thing I got from her.
I've got the best lawyer soft tacos can buy.
Objection.
On what grounds?
How about silliness, Your Honor?
I think legal terms are magic words that can force people to do what I want.
My client has instructed me to remind the court how rich and important he is, and that he is not like other men.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 402. I'm Thomas Smith. That's Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm fantastic, Thomas. I may never sleep again, but I'm fantastic. Yeah.
You know. Lots of news today.
And we were laughing 2 days ago about, you know, prep, because it was like, oh, there are a few stories to discuss this week. There are a few more, thanks to the Supreme Court this morning.
So. Yeah, this was weird. So, you know, there's always the thing where I'm on the West Coast, so everything happens, you know, it's a little earlier for me, and so I'm never up. Plus, you know, I'm a night person, so I sleep in a little bit. So I wake up, and I cannot wait for you to explain what's going on in these tax cases, because I literally had two sets of headlines from New York Times and Washington Post that each seemed to contradict each other. And New York Times was like, can't get a hold of Trump's documents. Good news, can get a hold of Trump's documents. And then the Washington Post did the same thing. And so I assume it's just the two different cases going two different ways. But I'm all kinds of confused. And that's why I love listening to the Opening Arguments podcast Fridays at, So I'm excited for you to explain that, because I do not know what's going on.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of really terrible takes going on right now, and I am excited to break down the Supreme Court's rulings in the two Trump tax cases, Trump versus Vance, Trump versus Mazars. I think we'll do that kind of right out of the box.
Awesome. Well, I know we also wanted to tease the fact that Andrew Seidel back on the show for Tuesday. We're so excited to have him again. I think it's going to be an angry Seidel.
I have it on good authority that he is not a well clown right now. So, we're going to be discussing the Supreme Court's religion cases. Lots of people have asked us about this, and you know, there's no better expert than Andrew Seidel from the FFRF. And we're going to break down Espinosa, the Little Sisters of the Poor case, like all of the religion cases that have come out in the past couple of weeks that you've wanted.
They were all bad, I'm pretty sure.
They were, yeah.
All bad. I could be wrong, but...
No, you're not. You are not wrong in any way whatsoever.
Very frustrating. But let's get to our first segment. Oh, by the way, we're also going to, just to give more teasers for today, we're also going to talk about the ICE, horrendous ICE rules that they're trying to do with colleges. And I want to know, I asked Andrew to make sure to have this answer. I want to know if the one weird trick that schools are going to try is going to work. We'll see how that goes. And then Andrew has something called a wild card segment in that I do not think we're getting to. I don't even
there's
know
why. There's zero chance, yeah.
I don't know why. That must have just been an inside joke for me that you typed that.
Yeah.
All right, let's get to our first segment. Andrew corrects all the horrible news coverage of these cases.
Down. 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 Down.
So what happened? Do we get Trump's documents or do we not get Trump? I don't know. What happened?
Yeah, look, we do. So here's the way to think about this. And I was saying this, you know, right as we were about to record. The press reports right now are very much going through what the press reports on the left went through during the 2018 midterm elections, right? And I was really, really proud of the fact that, like, we recorded the very next day and we said, these are great results, right? Like, yes, would have been super great to see Ted Cruz lose, but like, we did the most important thing, which was take back the House, which was the achievable thing that we could have done, right? And, you know, there were individual bad results. God, you know, Florida was a nightmare. There is almost no relief that I could imagine the Supreme Court awarding in the two Trump tax cases that would be better than what we got. So I'm going to break both of those down. I'm going to talk about also the immediate implications. And in fact, let's just preview that out right now, right? Lots of liberal sources are saying the president won because we're not going to get his tax returns before the November election. There are two things that you need to know about with respect to that. The first is, as of 9 a.m. this morning, I thought it was entirely possible that A, John Roberts might relist these two cases for the fall term, right? Thus, 100% putting them out of reach before the 2020 election. And that B, if they were considered in this term, that we could, at minimum, lose the Mazars case, right? That is the House congressional subpoenas. Those arguments aren't good. And as you will see, we won that case. We won it 7-2. But go back, and if you see, you know, liberal legal analysts, particularly on Twitter, talking about how this means, like, it's all going to be buried, like, blah, blah, that do a read of their July 8th tweets, right? Because a great many of these sources were saying John Roberts is going to John Roberts. He's going to split the baby. We're going to win in Vance. So the New York District Attorney, Cyrus Vance, is going to get Trump's taxes from Mazars. But we're going to lose in the Mazars Deutsche Bank cases. And the House Judiciary Committee is not going to be able to enforce those subpoenas. That was not the result. So, you know, particularly against the background.
Wait, it wasn't?
It was not. Both cases were 7-2 in favor
of
disclosure, right? You know, which I don't think anybody was predicting that. Certainly not me. And we're going to break down each of those. And I want to tell you, from a practical perspective, here's the way that I would handicap it. There is a 75% chance, maybe greater, that Cyrus Vance gets Donald Trump's taxes in enough time to impanel a grand jury and possibly hand down an indictment against the president. Now, mind you, that will be stayed, right? You can't, you know, go haul off a sitting president in handcuffs. It would be stayed until January of 2021. But I would say the odds are not just better than not, but significant that Cyrus Vance gets those documents and is able to impanel a grand jury, which would then, if the reporting in the New York Times is to be believed, which could then hand down an indictment of Donald Trump before the election.
So I'm confused. Apologies for this, but I thought we lost one and won one of these cases.
No, we won both cases. Cases.
So then they really are messing this up, because the alert told me one of the cases said we're not going to get the documents, and the other said we are going to get the documents.
Let's go into that right now. Okay. The misreporting is coming in the Trump versus Mazars case, right? So let's deal with that one first, even though that was chronologically decided later by about 10 minutes. The Mazars case was about the subpoenas directed to Mazars LLP, that's Trump's accounting firm, and Deutsche Bank regarding Trump's taxes, requiring that those entities turn over Trump's taxes so that the House could use them as the basis for drafting legislation requiring presidential candidates to disclose their taxes, and also potentially for investigation into the impeachment into Trump's actual wrongdoing. And Trump's argument in this case, in the Mazars case, was that's not a valid legislative purpose, right? That was Naomi Rao's dissent at the D.C. Circuit. And one that it was entirely plausible could have won 5 votes at the Supreme Court.
Not because it's right, but just because the Supreme Court.
because it's the Supreme Court, because that's how they've been ruling, right? It did not. It won exactly 2 votes, right? It won Sam Alito, who has now wrested the crown of the howleriest of the howler monkeys. He's king of Howler Monkey Mountain, and Clarence Thomas. And that's it. And the other 7 justices said, you know what? It's perfectly valid for the House Judiciary Committee to issue a subpoena to the President of the United States for information in connection with legitimate House oversight functions. And where this is coming out as a quote loss has to do with how people are reading the subsequent procedural history. And again, I would just ask these people, like, what did you think was going to happen, right? Like, when you win a case with a factual component, it gets remanded back down to the district court, right? Because the Supreme Court doesn't decide on facts and stuff, right? They decide on the law. So when people are saying we're definitely not going to get taxes released to the House Judiciary, I would say there's probably only about a 5% chance that comes in before November. So I think that more likely than not, the process is going to play out and it is going to take some time. But there's a pathway in which this goes back to the District Court for the District of Columbia, and it holds an expedited hearing and issues a ruling in late August. And once that ruling, because of the reasons that I'm about to explain to you, once that ruling is handed down, the onus will be on Donald Trump to, because you get to appeal rulings on the merits, but he will have to move to stay enforcement of the court's judgment enforcing the subpoenas, and he could lose on that motion to stay. And here's why. Because in the Mazars case, and again, remember, this got 7 votes, right? This is a broad, sweeping, truly bipartisan. This is one of the only cases that it's fair to say reflects bipartisan consensus on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and I was just paused for a second because maybe a note of slight optimism in this dark time is that still the 2 most idiotic justices are not the 2 most recent ones that Trump got to appoint.
That's right.
That's absolutely correct. Encouraging.
The Mazars decision, you can go to page 19, remands down to the district court, and it says, hey, you need to take a look at the subpoenas that are issued by the House Judiciary Committee, and you have to subject them to a 4-part test. That 4-part test is, first, you should assess whether the legislative purpose that is asserted by the House of Representatives warrants the significant step of involving the president and his papers. Congress may not rely on the president's information if other sources could reasonably provide Congress with the information it needs in light of that particular legislative objective. Okay, well, Trump's not too hard to pass that test, right? And again, like, that's a good principle to ask, right? Like, I do not want, you know, the Republican Congress in 2023, if there is such a thing, like issuing subpoenas for, you know, Joe Biden's dental records to prove that he uses those to broadcast secret messages from QAnon, right? Like, and you want to have some protection on that, right? So first, is there a legitimate legislative purpose that must involve the president? Second, the subpoena should be, quote, no broader than reasonably necessary, end of quote. That's a standard judicial term of art that's applicable whenever you have a third-party subpoena. So again, good criterion. Third, this says, courts should be attentive to the nature of the evidence offered by Congress to establish that the subpoena advances a valid legislative purpose. The more detailed and substantial the evidence of Congress's legislative purpose, the better. This is particularly true when Congress contemplates legislation that raises sensitive constitutional issues, such as legislation concerning the presidency. In such cases, it is, quote, impossible to conclude that a subpoena is designed to advance a valid legislative purpose unless Congress adequately identifies its aims and explains why the president's information will advance its consideration of possible legislation. And then it says, fourth, and this is where, you know, if you were Jay Sekulow, you might want to try and stack your chips. And the court knows this. So these opinions are both written by John Roberts, and they are both essentially like, to the extent that they give advice to Jay Sekulow, right? It's kind of like, you know, the really, really small kid on the T-ball team that, you know, you like help on up to the tee and you give him a couple of extra swings and, you know, you stand behind him or whatever. And this is John Roberts saying, okay, Jay, buddy, like, I know you're going to litigate this, and here's how you do it. He says, courts should be careful to assess the burdens imposed on the president by a subpoena. But then in the, like, helping Jay swing the bat says, we have held that burdens on the president's time and attention stemming from judicial process and legislation, without more, generally do not cross constitutional lines. John Roberts had to say that because pretty much Sekulow's entire argument was, come on, president's super busy right now. And like, you know, requiring him to like do stuff would interfere with his, you know, busy golfing schedule or what have you. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, that's not good enough. They do then say burdens imposed by a congressional subpoena should be carefully scrutinized, for they stem from a rival political branch that has an ongoing relationship with the president and incentives to use subpoenas for political advantage. That's true. Again, just remember what the Tea Party caucus would do with, you know, a broad ranging opinion here. And then they add, and this is sort of truly surprising for a Roberts opinion that garnered the signatures of Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, other considerations may be pertinent as well. One case every two centuries does not afford enough experience for an exhaustive list. I you heard me chuckle at that, Rick, because that is the kind of thing that a reasonable jurist applying the ordinary principles of law would say, right? Like, you know, remember, he's writing this to hardcore textualists and originalists who think that, like, yeah, one case from 1789 is just fine. Like, no, this is like, come on, like, we don't have an awful lot of guidance here. We're in sort of new waters. And then it says, when Congress seeks information needed for intelligent legislative action, it unquestionably remains the duty of all citizens to cooperate. And then, you know, it goes on to say, you know, we're still mindful of special powers. So that's how this case is going back to the district court. This case is going back to the district court for the trial judge to say, do the congressional subpoenas meet this four-part test? And here's the crucial part that, as far as I know, I'm the only person that is making this argument. A couple of other people have agreed with my conclusions. Jill Wine Banks is out in front. I think people have said that Neil Katyal on MSNBC has said the same thing. But, you know, I kind of went back and forth with our buddy Randall Eliason, and he didn't reply to this point, so I hope that I've convinced him on this. If you're a naysayer, if you're on the side of, oh, we lost this decision because the Supreme Court crafted this four-point test and then they sent it back, and now there's going to be, you know, a huge trial on the merits, and even after that decision comes out, it will get appealed to the D.C. Circuit, and that will move for reconsideration en banc, and that will go back up to the Supreme Court, and, you know, there's no way that we're going to get that in 4 months.
Yeah,
that's true. There's no way we're going to get that in 4 months, but we don't need to get that. All we need to get is for the district court to rule on the merits that the subpoenas are enforceable, that they meet the Supreme Court's four-part test, and then for the D.C. Circuit not to stay enforcement of that judgment pending appeal. That's all you need. Now, the argument for why they should stay enforcement of the judgment pending appeal is the political consequence, right? Is the president might not get reelected and the case might get mooted. But that's not typically the kind of reason that you give for mooting a case, right? Like, it doesn't, that doesn't moot a case from a standing point, right? Like, this is still, the president will still be subject to the subpoena whether he is in office or not, right? So that's not a fantastic reason for staying the effect of the judgment that, you know, yeah, that they're going to get the information. Is it irreparable harm? It certainly would be irreparable harm in the sense that once you have information, it's kind of hard to put the genie back in the bottle. But that's going to be outweighed by the fact that the judicial determination, you heard me go through those four steps. In each of those four steps, the Supreme Court went out of its way to say that the courts are evaluating factual considerations. And you know from having done the show now for 4 years, the significance of the court emphasizing that these are fact-based inquiries, right? Because when you review what a district court does on the law, you review the law de novo, but you review facts with extreme deference to the fact-finding done by the trial court. This is why I said, look, 5%, right? Like there are a large group of possibilities in which the trial court takes too long, the DC Circuit grants a stay, the Supreme Court grants an administrative stay, you know, something like that. Like, yes, there are a lot of grounds in which the House does not get this information from Deutsche Bank or Mazars before the election. But there's a path in which they do, right? There's a path in which the district court expedites the materials. Mazars turns, because again, remember, like we're outside of talking about Donald Trump and his inner circle of cronies, right? We're talking about Deutsche Bank,
yeah,
already under heightened scrutiny by the U.S. government, and Mazars LLP, a global, you know, multi-hundred-thousand accountant firm worth billions of dollars. And if you look at it and say, you know, I mean, even Deutsche Bank, as obstructionist as they've been, like you look at it and go, all right, like kind of looks like Trump's going down in flames. Like, I don't know how much we want to piss them off.
I know this argument already was stupid that Trump is too busy, but isn't the fact that we're talking about Mazars and, you know, Deutsche Bank, isn't Trump doing more work by fighting this than he would by just letting these other companies give the files or whatever?
Yes.
Like, sorry, I don't have time for Deutsche Bank to give you my files. What?
Yeah, that's right. And we're going to talk about that in more detail in the when as we move to the Vance case. But what I want to use as the transition to the Vance case, because this is my very, very favorite thing about today. And it is my piece of advice for the House lawyers who are going to be relitigating the case back at the trial court level in Mazars. And it is this: when you are arguing how to apply the 4-point test, the person who has already done the hard work for you and scored an own goal in such convincing fashion that I leave it to Thomas to craft the ideal hockey analogy right here is King of the Howler Monkeys himself, Samuel Alito, who writes in an effort to like display how, you know, sarcastically stupid he thinks the Vance decision is. This is page 21 of his dissent. It's almost all the way at the bottom of the entire 68-page document. Alito says, now, the court says that a president can, and then he uses sarcasm italics, can argue that compliance with a particular subpoena would impede his constitutional duties. Emphasis added, right, to let you know that he was the one that put in the sarcasm italics. But under the court's opinions in this case and Mazars, it is not easy to see how such an argument could prevail. The court makes clear that any stigma or damage to a president's reputation does not count. And in Mazars, the court states that burdens on the president's time and attention are generally not of constitutional concern. Elsewhere in its opinion of this case, the court takes the position that when a president's non-official records are subpoenaed, his treatment should be little different from that of any other subpoena recipient. The most that this court holds out is the possibility that there might be some unspecified extraordinary circumstances under which a president might obtain relief. If that is not block quoted by the House Democrats in their argument to the district court in Mazars, then they're not doing their job, right? Like, because that is Sam Alito being like, I don't understand. It's now like, how am I supposed to protect Donald Trump anymore? Thanks to my idiot brothers on the Supreme Court that I thought we were supposed to have the like secret handshake down about ixnay on the ump tray. It's just such a spectacular concession that there isn't additional fact finding to do, and that the court could very easily in both cases turn around and go, yep, turn it over.
I'm just so confused, and I apologize for this, but like, I'm looking at my, you know, on the coverage right now that has led me to be confused. Vox, who I normally trust, says Mazars, what does the Supreme Court ruling on Trump v. Mazars really mean? It says by the time Trump's records become available, he will almost certainly either be an ex-president or firmly entrenched in his second term. In short, it's a powerful victory for Trump. And the other part is the court holds that there are special rules for the president. So what gives?
Let me first re-explain Mazars, because there's a portion of that that's almost correct, right? And that is, in Mazars, the court says that there is a role for the Supreme Court in adjudicating a congressional subpoena directed at a president asserting a legislative privilege, right? Asserting a legislative action, right? And I want to say, first, remember that we discussed the Naomi Rao-led opinion in the D.C. Circuit that was incomprehensible, that said, nope, sorry, these are non-justiciable, right? Like, Congress wants a subpoena and Don McGahn thinks the executive privilege covers that. Like, who are we at the courts to adjudicate such a thing, right? Like, and we laughed and we said, like, well, because subpoena, right? Like, we went through and we're like, if the judiciary is not there to intermediate between the executive branch and the legislative branch, like, then what the hell are they there for? Right. Yeah. Like that's the whole, like, I'm just a bit right. Like, you go back to, you know, Schoolhouse Rock, like that's your job, man. So I think that this will influence the McGahn case. I think it absolutely has a bearing on the assertions being made by McGahn and that were prominent in the Rao opinion, which is absolutely going to be overturned by the en banc DC circuit. They have yet to rule on that, but they may have been holding that case pending these subpoena cases. That's a possibility. And B, like, let's tackle that Vox sentence. Yes, the president is different than a normal person when it comes to a congressional subpoena. Right. And the brilliance of the Mazars opinion is that it is designed. It is truly like the kind of Supreme Court opinion we used to see 30 years ago. Right. Like it's not sitting there going like, oh, well, you know, the liberals are on this side because it's going to stick it to Trump and the conservatives are on this side to protect Donald Trump. Right. It is both sides kind of looking at it going, this is not, our politics are broken right now. And if you think that subpoena issued to Donald Trump by Democrats right now is all there's ever going to be, then, you know, you haven't been paying attention to Mitch McConnell, right? Like, you haven't been paying attention to the House Freedom Caucus, right? Like,
yeah, I was wondering how much of this could be the more sensible right-wing justices on the court being like, I don't think we're going to have a Republican president next term. So like, yeah,
or maybe ever again, right? Like, who knows? But that's right. Like, and again, you have to construct rules that make sense out of that. Now, the rule that would have made no sense is the rule that the DC circuit temporarily adopted, and that Trump was urging, particularly as we move over to the Vance case, which is absolute executive immunity, right? I'm the president. I'm immune from process. It doesn't count. I'm special, and there's nothing you can do about it. Or if there is something you can do about it, you can only do something about it in the abstract. And if you think I'm being facetious on that, I want to read you from Clarence Thomas's dissent in the Vance case, because this is a truly shocking thing to say, and I'm going to tell you it's truly shocking on face, and then it becomes 100% evidence of absolute partisan hackery. We get Corey Robin to come back on the show. Like, you cannot defend Clarence Thomas saying the following, quote, "I agree with the majority that the president is not entitled to absolute immunity from," sarcasm italics, "issuance of the subpoena, but he may be entitled to relief against its," sarcasm italics, "enforcement." Seriously, that's what they're saying. Clarence Thomas is saying, sure, like, you can issue a subpoena all you want, but, like, yeah. I mean, you can't enforce it. Now, that's a stupid thing to say. It is an indefensibly stupid thing to say when 23 years earlier, you, Clarence Thomas, joined the majority in Clinton versus Jones that enforced a subpoena against Bill Clinton. These concerns were entirely absent, right? That, oh, well, the president should be entitled to relief from enforcement because of separation. They were nowhere. Clarence Thomas did not concur in part and dissent in part in Clinton v. Jones.
That's even including the fact that, you know, usually sexual predators stick together, but, like, that's how partisan Clarence Thomas is. His partisanship transcends other bonds.
If you're sitting there looking and going, I want a Supreme Court opinion that most sticks it to Donald Trump, I would just say, like, go back in time, right? Like, if that was probably that those kinds of voices were probably voices that were critical of the Clinton versus Jones opinion too, right? And again, all you have to do is just emotively put yourself on the other side, right? Like, it was, I mean, that was truly a politically motivated witch hunt that went so far afield of its original mission, that was designed to bring down the Clinton presidency, and everything was pretextual about it. But I got to tell you, like, I'm super glad that the court, in a bipartisan way, said, yeah, like, presidents don't get to, like, pretend that lawsuits don't happen because you're president, right? You don't get to say, like, oh, well, you know, I'm the executive branch, and the executive branch is on base, and the floor is lava, and, you know, the judiciary can't do anything about it. Like, we didn't say that, you know, 25 years ago, and they reaffirmed that principle today. And that, by the way, is the summary. I should say, we could obviously do a full hour on this segment. We could do 2 hours. We could do four. The reason why is, as we move from the finish on the Mazars case, so let me summarize Mazars. Mazars was the House Committee on the Judiciary issued subpoenas to third parties requesting documents, including Trump's tax returns, for the purpose of crafting legislation to require presidents to release their tax returns so as to enforce the congressional prohibitions on emoluments, right? That was the stated reason given in those subpoenas. The president's argument in that case was that they did not serve a valid legislative purpose, and as a larger principle, that the president enjoyed absolute immunity and, you know, the courts lacked the power to enforce subpoenas like this. And the Supreme Court completely rejected those arguments. They said that Congress is entitled to subpoena the president, that we should be aware that that has political implications, and that courts should use a fact-intensive four-part test. And that, by the way, not just a four-part test, but, you know, one case every two centuries probably does not afford enough experience for an exhaustive list, right? So if something is obviously pretextual in, you know, 2 years against Joe Biden, a court could say, you know, even if it doesn't necessarily meet the first four criteria, could use that, you know, sort of catch-all provision and say, my factual determination is that this is not a valid legislative privilege. It's exactly the right result. Huh. In terms of timing, right? I agree with you, man. Like, I would love to tell you that we will go down, it will be expedited, and that the House will get their documents, you know, in September. I can't tell you that, but yesterday I thought that chance was zero, right? Today it's not zero. And more importantly, the Supreme Court set rules that constrain this president and every president hereafter. And that's a good thing. So that's Mazars. Vance is the case that everybody thought was the stronger case, right? So
stronger for who?
Stronger for the forces of light, right?
Oh, okay.
In terms of being able to compel the subpoena.
Yeah, stronger for elves and wizards.
Yeah, high elves only, not dark elves. Yeah.
Yeah.
This was the New York District Attorney, Cyrus Vance, had subpoenaed Deutsche Bank and Mazars for Trump's taxes. And we don't entirely know why, but we can strongly suspect that they relate to two pieces of publicly available information. The first is testimony by Michael Cohen related to how Donald Trump had adjusted, fraudulently adjusted, in Michael Cohen's view, the value of real estate, depending on whether he was appraising it for tax purposes, where he would value it as cheaply as possible, or for loan purposes with Deutsche Bank, where he would value it as expansively as possible, right? You know. And so that's part of the documents, in addition to just the taxes, that Vance was seeking from Deutsche Bank, right? If you file your taxes on, you know, Monday and say this piece of property is worth $28 million, and then you file a loan application on Tuesday that says it's worth $900 million, that's pretty strong evidence of criminal fraud.
So quick point of clarification, because I'm sure some people were confused like me. We're now talking about Trump v. Vance.
Correct.
But Vance had tried to get stuff from Mazars.
Yes, I know. Okay. Same group of operative players, right?
Gotcha. Just a different person trying to get access to the Mazars records.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. There was also, I don't know if you have read this, there was exceptional reporting done in the New York Times. One of my debaters actually used this article. It's a super lengthy article, and used multiple citations from it at Debate Nationals this year, which were virtual. They were held online, but that piece documents really comprehensively that the Trump family used mechanisms ranging from creative tax classification to outright fraud to take Fred Trump's money and put it in the pockets of Donald Trump, right, to build the contemporary Trump empire. You put those two pieces together and we have strong reasons to believe. And again, right, people are innocent until proven guilty with Donald Trump. It's hard to say that without laughing. Yeah. But we have strong reasons to believe that Donald Trump has committed criminal tax fraud. And the question was, is Cy Vance going to get the evidence necessary to make that case? And the answer now is yes. And not only is he going to get it, but he's going to get it by August. The important thing, this is where your sources are, you know, who are saying this is a split win, that are viewing this case the wrong way. This is where they have a point, right? Which is when Vance gets Trump's tax returns, those will be subject to grand jury proceedings, right? Those are subpoenas issued by a grand jury. And they are confidential, as we know from the redactions from the Mueller report, right? Grand jury material is confidential. So Cy Vance will not be able to leak those documents when he receives
We can't
them.
Do any sort of immunity trick or...
It when Vance has them, could the House Judiciary Committee...
They fall out of the back of the truck, maybe, and someone
picks them up. He's not going to violate the rules of legal ethics.
Oh, I left them on the company printer by accident. Whoops.
But here's what could happen, right? The House could subpoena Cy Vance to turn them over, right?
Oh,
I mean, like, there are
that's
whole,
interesting.
There are a whole bunch of different...
So then right? can like, he just turn them over, or is there a thing where then Trump gets to be like, hey, I also am going to take time suing this guy to not turn them over because I don't have time to have this guy give you my records. But in all seriousness, would Trump be able to sue for Vance to not turn those over, or can Vance at that point just turn them over?
What Trump would have to do is what he's done in the existing cases to date, right? Which is move to intervene and for an injunction blocking them. But when you comply with a facially valid subpoena, that is a defense, right, against any kind of criminal wrongdoing, right? So in other words, part of the reason that's worked to date is that everybody who has copies of the relevant documents is either a hardcore Trump toady or somebody who is subservient, right? Don McGahn, right? Or is somebody who is subservient to Trump and, you know, not willing to take him on, i.e., you know, the general counsel of Mazars. And look, like, if I were the general counsel of Mazars, I would make that same recommendation, right? Like, it if you're acting to protect the best interests of your multinational corporation, having a reputation for it, yeah, sure. Like, we turn over even the president's record, right? Like, that's not real great for business, right? So the dynamics change the minute this is out of the bag. And that's why you see the administration fighting so hard to make sure that the things that they don't want people to see do not get into the hands of people who are willing to take Trump on, right? It's why they're fighting so hard to make sure that the House does not get the fully unredacted Mueller reports, right? That Judge Reggie Walton has, that he's viewed in camera. Right. So,
yeah, but I thought a total exoneration. So shouldn't we want to get a hold of that?
You'd think, right? Yeah. Quickly to summarize. So Cy Vance impaneled a grand jury. They issued subpoenas for various bank records and same situation. Mazars, Deutsche Bank said, look, we need guidance, right? You have what looks like a valid subpoena issued here by a grand jury, and we want to comply with the law. On the other hand, the president of the United States has asserted executive immunity, which says we shouldn't comply with it, and we just don't know what to do. And so the position they took in this litigation was, hey, man, just tell us what to do and we'll do it. Right. And now the Supreme Court has said, and the ruling in Trump v. Vance is that the only defenses that Donald Trump may raise, this gets remanded too, but again, because these are cases, because they're fact-finding to do, the only defenses that Donald Trump has are the same defenses as any other citizen to a subpoena issued by a grand jury, right? And good, like, he shouldn't have less, right? Like, his argument this entire time, ad oral argument, was absolute executive privilege. And the Supreme Court said, not only do you not have absolute executive, but when it comes to a subpoena issued in a criminal case, you have no privileges beyond that of an ordinary American citizen. And by the way, like, those defenses suck, right? Like, I shouldn't have to tell you that, right? Like, if you get a subpoena requiring you to testify,
I never get out of it.
yeah, right. And same thing applies here in terms of when you go to the court and petition, this will be the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, and you petition the court for that, you know, one of the, like, really narrow exceptions to the subpoena, that's a fact-intensive inquiry. And when the judge says, nope, you are 100, I feel, I don't want to say 100%. You never say 100 in the law. I am 90% confident that the judge will uphold that the conjunction of this, right? Think of the high level of probabilities to have all of these things occur. But again, I feel like this is what will happen. The judge will convene a hearing. Trump will raise stupid arguments. The judge will say, okay, we've heard your arguments. Not good. Deutsche Bank, Mazars, we're going to require you to turn over the information requested by the subpoena. Trump will appeal to the Second Circuit, and the Second Circuit will decline to stay enforcement of the judgment pending appeal. He may then appeal to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, I think, will deny enforcement of the judgment pending appeal, because consistent with this opinion, you would just say we issue subpoenas all the time. The fact that this is the president, the opinion tells you, you evaluate this as if it were any other person, and we would never ever grant cert to intervene to stop, you know, a court from issuing a subpoena against somebody. So, you know, too bad, turn over the documents. And the courts will emphasize, right, that grand jury materials are secret. So there's no irreparable harm. Like, it's just, there's nothing, in my view. And again, the last 4 years have taught me, don't say 100%. It is very difficult for me to imagine how Cy Vance does not have in his possession the records subpoenaed from Deutsche Bank and Mazars. With, you know, they made with some exceptions, but materially important, valuable records regarding Donald Trump's finances within 2 months.
By the end of August. Hurry up. Go faster. 2 months.
I agree. The wheels of justice churn slowly, my friend.
Wasn't sure if that was like a bureaucratic, like the company's going to drag its feet or something.
I believe, I could be wrong on this. I'm here to analyze the law, not, you know, what I think I saw on Twitter. But I think both companies have said we're prepared to comply with the subpoena if the court orders us to. Yeah, I think they've got those documents segregated and prepared and. That would be a real tough argument to make. I know, because I've had to do this before. Like when I was at Covington and Burling and I was sent in as a, fifth year associate, like, hey, you've always wanted to argue a motion, right? Well, why don't you go argue, the other side of this motion to compel? And I had to go in and say, well, we're going to need an extra 6 months to produce. And, I've had the judge look at me and say, Mr. Torres, how many lawyers are in your firm? And, the answer then was 335. the answer now is, right, several thousand, right? Like it's,
yeah.
It's,
but I ask one of them to get this. Yeah. So I want to make sure we get to our main story today.
Yes. Yes. We do have to get to that.
But does that settle it for Trump v. Vance? So
that settles it for Trump v. Vance.
Top line is you think he's going to be able to get these documents, and then who knows from there? We might
and then the grand jury may hand down an indictment, and it can indict Donald Trump in one of two ways, right? And again,
sealed indictment,
right? A sealed indictment that is not released until January of 2021, or he could be indicted as a John Doe, right? He could be indicted as an unnamed co-conspirator along with, Fred Trump, the estate of Fred Trump or whatever, and Donald Trump Jr. and the Trump Organization and all of that. And it would be like, well, individual dash one.
I wonder who this is. Yeah.
Who knows? Could be any sitting president of the United States.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Policy Genius. Folks, shopping for life insurance can raise a lot of questions. How much coverage do you need? Which insurance company is the best one? How much should it even cost? And at a time when it's more important than ever to have life insurance, the pandemic is making it a little more complicated to shop for. That's where Policy Genius can help. Now, I'll say this. I grabbed life insurance long before this pandemic. You know why? Because I thought it was the right decision. I'm glad I made that decision. I got ahead of it. But it's okay if you didn't. You still can. You can do it today with Policy Genius. As a life insurance marketplace, they are backed by a team of experts. Policy Genius is keeping track of all the changes in the market so that you don't have to. They'll find you the right amount of coverage at the best possible price without the headache. Policy Genius compares quotes from the top life insurance companies in one place. It takes just a few minutes to compare quotes from the top insurers to find your best price. This doesn't just save a lot of legwork. You could save $1,500 or more a year by using Policy Genius to compare life insurance policies. Once you apply, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and the red tape for free. So, if you hit any speed bumps during the application process, they'll be there to take care of everything. So if you need life insurance but you're not sure where to start, head to policygenius.com. Policy Genius will find you the best rate and handle the process completely. They'll get you and your family protected and hopefully give you one less thing to worry about. Try it today. That's policygenius.com. Now it's time to get to our main segment, Andrew. it's all co-main segments. It's like a really good UFC where you have like co-main events or something.
Yeah.
This is just absolutely, talk about deplorable. The headlines that ICE was going to try to deport students that because everything is online now, international students don't need to be here or something like that. So why don't you explain this awfulness and then maybe what we can do about this awfulness?
I will. And I will tell you, right, the the hero we need and possibly the hero we deserve is going to be Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology that have sued to block this rule from going into effect. And I think they have a good chance of succeeding in getting an injunction. I think they have a high likelihood of success on the merits. I'm going to explain what's happening. And I want to bracket, right? Like you start off with deplorables. And I wanted to open the segment with perhaps the most racist thing of 2017, right? It's a big contest, but I think I've got a strong contender, if not the number one, when, you know, Corn Goblin Steve King said, you know, for everyone who's a valedictorian, there's another 100 of them out there that weigh 130 pounds and they've got calves the size of cantaloupes because they're hauling 75 pounds of marijuana across the desert. That was racist enough to get Steve King kicked out of Congress, right? You know, I mean, ultimately by the voters, right? I want to point out the Trump administration's policy is now targeting explicitly the valedictorians, right? This is a policy that is designed to send home thousands of students in this lawsuit alone at Harvard and MIT, right? No word on the size of their calves. This truly is, right? Like this, I wanted to begin with that because we should rightfully mock the idea that, you know, discrimination against people, doesn't count when they're sending us their quote best and brightest, and that, right, the elitism and classism that is implicit in that are things that we've decried on the show at great length. But I want to point out, it is now just naked racism, right? Like these are things that sending home valedictorians at Harvard because they're brown. There's only one reason to do that. So here's what happened, and it's a little bit complicated, but I think I can kind of navigate us through it. So our existing immigration laws permit foreign nationals to come over to the U.S. and study. And in fact, from a geostrategic reason, right? Like
it's one of the best things we can possibly do, and we should do more of it.
All of that, right? But I want to tell you, if you look in the literature, if you look in the international relations literature, even till now, right, you will find hardcore neocons, right, like Bill Kristol types who argue, John Bolton types who argue that our program of bringing in students from China to study in U.S. universities is one of the most important geostrategic things that we do, right? Because 85% of foreign students who come to the United States stay in the United States in high-tech fields like AI. Again, these folks, no friends of ours, are arguing like, which would you rather have? Super genius students from our geostrategic rivals going home or staying here and benefiting the United States? And so, this is one of these where like humanity intersects with like the darkest, most self-interested, right? Like nobody, unless you are a racist, right? There's no reason to not want this policy.
So Q, racist, not wanting this policy.
Q, racist, not wanting this policy. So here's what happens. You have two different kinds of student visas. F visas for academic students. And then there are F1 and F2. F1 is the student. F2 are their dependents, which are their spouse or their minor children, right? So you apply, you get either the F visa if you're in an academic course, or you get an M as in monster visa if you're in a non-academic or a vocational technical course. And again, remember, this is higher education, so you know it plenty of the vocational technical courses are still highly specialized, you know, STEM fields of education. Again, not that it should matter. I don't know why I'm like, you know, trying to reach out to our non-existent neocon audience here, but but I want to emphasize like just how extreme this is, right? So, okay, you get an F visa, you get an M visa. And under those visas, you are required to attend classes, and you are required to attend classes in person to continue to comply with the visas. And again, When you don't have a pandemic, that makes total sense. But on March 9th, the administrators of the Student Exchange Visitor Program, SEVP, issued an administrative interpretation. It is message 2003-01, and it was entitled COVID-19 and Potential Procedural Adaptations for F&M Non-Immigrant Students. And basically what that said was, it's March. The president has just declared a state of emergency with respect to COVID-19. That looks like that's going to be bad. And so here are the policies at SEVP certified schools with respect to students who are here on F and M visas. And basically what that said was, we want you to be able to maintain your course of study as normally as possible, right? But we recognize that there's a pandemic. So what we want you to do is keep us posted at the school level of any changes in policy. And subsequently, they sought guidance from and received it from ICE, right? So again, all of this is on March 9th. And they said, hey, how do you want to handle the typical enforcement of the requirements of the F&M visas? And ICE, and again, we'll link this document in the show notes, ICE said there are kind of three situations that we can think of, right? The first is if the school closes and is unable to offer classes online. And in that situation, we're going to treat that like a break, right? Like spring break. Hmm. And so F&M visa students are going to be treated just as active students are, right? So long as you file a certification that says, yes, as soon as the school offers classes again, I intend to re-enroll, we're going to treat this like spring break. You know, right? You don't get deported from the country if you're here on an F&M visa because the school closes for 2 weeks. That's how they're treated.
I mean, am I unreasonable to think this already feels really weird that they're this active about, like, if you don't have a hall pass for 5 seconds as an international student, you might just get deported?
The more I look at this, right? Because again, I'm reading the good rules here. These are the ones that were superseded.
Yeah.
Right. But your point is very well taken, right? Like, if you really want to feel a privilege in this country, like, delve into any of these. So you're correct. So that was the first kind of possibility. If the school's not offering classes, then you treat it as a break and you should be treated like every other one. Then the second situation was if the school stops in-person classes and then shifts it online and the visa student remains in the United States. And before issuing this May 9th guidance, this March 9th guidance, the rule was if you elected to take your classes online, then you would be subject to deportation under the F or M visa. And again, you can construct the reason for that, right? Like, hey, well, if you're taking it online, you don't have to be in this country to do that. However, on March 9th, ICE suspended that rule and cited, quote, the extraordinary nature of the COVID-19 emergency and declared, quote, that the exception would be in effect for the duration of the emergency and in accordance with procedural change documents filed in a timely manner to SEVP, the Student Exchange and Visitor Program. So what does that mean? That means, yeah, we get it. Ordinarily, if you're taking classes online, you got to go home. We're suspending that rule for the duration of the emergency. That duration, as you might imagine, still going on. Same thing. What happens if the school closes, offers online classes, and the visa student left the United States, right? Because many of these kids went home. I mean, think about that. Like, suppose you're 19, you're here, right? And there's a corona outbreak. Like,
yeah, you might want to get home before you're stuck forever.
Yeah, I want to go home too. And again, I said, we're going to treat that like the previous situation. If you're online, that's fine. You're still considered an active enrollee. We're suspending the rule for the duration of the emergency. And the third was, and we're going to suspend that rule whether you stay in the United States or whether you go home, right? So in other words, like, you would still then have all the rights of an F or an M visa student, right? To be able to come and go from the country, whether you went home for the first part of the crisis or stayed in the United States. So even if the student left the U.S., their visa would still be valid. They could resume in-person classes as soon as COVID-19 is over, if COVID-19 is ever over. That's what I, and again, like, oh, we're not done. This episode is full of, you know, we're talking about villains making these pronouncements, right? Like, this is ICE making these pronouncements, right? So not the ACLU, just ordinary people trying to do their jobs, even in Trump's immigration.
And the Trump administration said, that's not evil enough. Sorry.
Not only did they do that, here's the timing. And this is raised in Harvard's lawsuit. On July 3rd, Harvard's School of Design, School of Public Health, the Law School, the Divinity School, and the School of Government. So some of those are undergraduate colleges. Some of those are postgraduate schools. They announced that for 2020, in the fall term, that all courses would be online. The School of Education followed suit later the same day. Those were mostly graduate programs. Got a little bit of media attention. There were stories that said Harvard is going online. And then Harvard University, the Faculty of Arts and Science, announced on July 6th that all undergraduate classes would be offered solely online for fall of 2020. And on that same day, July 6th, that's when ICE issued their revised guidelines. And the title of that announcement is SEVP modifies temporary exemptions for non-immigrant students taking online classes during the fall of 2020. And it is classified as a, quote, clarification to the prior rule. And it does exactly what you would think it does, right? It says, oh, yeah, that thing we said in March, we're not doing that thing anymore. And the previous rule is going to go back into effect. All active F1 and M1 students must transfer to a school with in-person instruction or leave the United States. If not, they will be in violation of their visa and they may be deported. Now, you tasked me with the question of the one weird trick.
Yeah, so there were people who were like, let's make a kind of a, I guess, fake class, but, you know, let's make a class that's like an optional, but you, attendance is, I don't know if it's mandatory, but you can somehow fudge it so that it's like you're attending that class. It's one unit, that kind of thing. Will that save all these students?
That will not save these students. The regulations require, for example, if you are on the M1 visa, you may not take more than one class or 3 credit hours online.
What? Gosh.
And what you have to do is you have to fill out this form I-20. Again, kind of sticking with your theme, this is something every student here, every non-immigrant student here studying abroad in the United States has to fill out every year, right? I mean, just sort of think about that. Like, it's just another thing of like, oh, when you go to college, like, oh, of course I have to fill out an I-20 that describes the college that I'm attending and why am I, you know, proves to the government that I'm doing that. You know, just another bit in the background. So there are potential hybrid plans, but those hybrid plans are restricted by credit hours, and the school has to describe to SEVP exactly how those plans operate. It says, and I'm just going to read from the order, for the fall 2020 semester, continuing F and M students who are already in the U.S. may remain in active status only if they make normal progress in a program of study, engage in an approved practical training, either as part of a program of study or following completion of a program of study. If a school changes its operational stance mid-semester, and as a result, a non-immigrant student switches to only online classes, or a non-immigrant student changes their course selections and as a result ends up taking an entirely online course load, schools are reminded that non-immigrant students within the United States are not permitted to take a full course of study through online classes. If non-immigrant students find themselves in this situation, they must leave the country or take alternative steps to maintain their non-immigrant status, such as transferring to a school with in-person instruction. So, this is, the cruelty is the point. The racism is the point. Fortunately, I don't think this, quote, clarification is going to stand. I don't think it's going to stand because of the lawsuit that Harvard and MIT have filed against ICE.
Well, I'm glad we aren't simply relying on one weird tricks.
Yeah. Their argument is, hey, man, we relied on the guidance issued by ICE and issued by the relevant agency, SEVP, back in March when we said we were going online.
A lot of filings are starting with hey man lately. I think it's because the law is so weird now that you're like, hey, come on, you know, every single filing.
Of Harvard's 23,000 students, 5,000 have F1 visas. At MIT, 11,500 students, 4,000 have F1 visas.
That is a significant chunk.
It absolutely is a significant chunk. And you can't take tens of thousands of, and again, you know, I mean, they're just in Massachusetts alone, you can't take tens of thousands of kids and say, oh, well, you know, time to transfer over to, you know, like, how in the hell do you do that in, you know, this is July and the certifications are due in the beginning of August, right? So I think, and the lawsuit, so begins with that detrimental reliance and then says, pursuant to the Administrative Procedure Act, we've talked about this before, ICE gave zero reason whatsoever for reversing its position. And again, we've talked about this with Trump administrative actions today.
Yeah, usually you have to give notice, have good, well, I don't know what applies in this case, but is it going to be one of those things where this is just too fast for people to be able to rely on policy going forward kind of thing?
Not only did they evade the notice and comment period.
Right.
Right. But yeah, right. When an administrative agency changes its course, it is entitled to substantial deference, right? The argument you have to make is that it is arbitrary and capricious. And that's a hard thing to prove unless you have an agency abruptly reversing course as the coronavirus got worse to undo the exceptions that they put into place when it was
5 minutes
less
ago.
Worse. Yeah, exactly. And is it arbitrary and capricious? When you give no analysis whatsoever, those are the kinds of cases in which courts say, yeah, this is arbitrary and capricious. So generally speaking, you do not want to be attacking an administrative agency and saying their reasons were arbitrary and capricious. This is the fog mirror kind of test, but there's no mirror, and they are. And so usually I would say, you know, my estimation of the likelihood of prevailing on proving something arbitrary and capricious is pretty low. I don't think the schools are going to have any difficulty proving that.
So is this enjoined yet, or will it be enjoined right away kind of thing?
As of today, it has not yet been enjoined, but the case was filed yesterday. So look.
Yeah.
It's going to move quickly, right? Because it is requesting both a TRO, temporary restraining order, and both preliminary and permanent injunctive relief, preventing the July 6th ICE order from going into effect. But that's going to happen soon. And I feel very, very confident. We will continue to monitor. I'll be shocked if the court does not enjoin that policy from going into effect. And again, district court, in the District of Massachusetts, this would then go up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeal. So, you know, we're not talking about the 11th Circuit. We're not talking about a place where you can roll the dice and, you know, maybe come up with Trump appointees. Although again, right, remember, part of the damage here is that Donald Trump has appointed an awful lot of folks to the judiciary across the country. But I feel pretty good about this one. And I would say, you know, if you are a student on an F or an M visa, like, don't go home today, right? Like, wait to see what happens.
I mean, unless you want to.
Yeah, right. But don't give up hope, because I think that's
yeah. But what a horrific, racist, asshole, evil thing to do.
It is.
We need to be rid of these people.
Yeah.
Abolish ICE and all that stuff. Sorry. Anyway.
But again, remember, like, the ICE March order, right? Like, I'm with you on abolish ICE, but. Right. Like, we're helped by the fact that the March order also came from ICE. Right. Like, it's sort of like, even, you know, the foot soldiers in this were like, well, I didn't think you were going to send home Harvard educated valedictorians.
4,000 MIT students or whatever. Come on.
There you go. I mean, relatively good news showed. I know we're covering a horrible thing, but it's a horrible thing that's going to get better. Yeah. Good news show.
And thank you.
And now it is time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. By the way, Lot Awful Movies coming at you real soon within the week. So look forward to that. But why don't you start us off, Andrew?
Yeah, thank you to Learned Hand Slaps Trump, to Andrew P.P. Torres, I Like Peeing Totally Clear. Fine. I will read 8-year-old humor all day long if you sign up as a patron. To James Andrini, I hope that's a former opposing counsel, James Andrini. To Cullen, to Graham Forbes, Edward Melishinsky, and Andrea Hesse. Take it away, Thomas.
And thank you to Christy, Sybil Shanks, the prison cat. Huh. It's a beautiful day to demand justice for Breonna Taylor. Yeah.
Yes,
originalists read the law like they read their Bible, poorly. Michael Jesch and Michael Dion, or Dion, or I don't know why I got all fancy with that. One way or the other, thank you so much for being a patron.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And we are joined by special guest Andrew Seidel. Not sure if, Andrew, are you familiar with what we do on the show? Oh, that's right. You've been on like 47 times. I think you know the deal. We're doing T3BE as a little sneak peek of the fact that we're having you on Tuesday to, if I have my way, do some yelling. How's it going, Andrew?
I mean, I've been better. I'm getting geared up to yell. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do it. Save that rage for Tuesday's episode. But for now, it is time for T3BE, and I think I got the last one right. So I picked myself up off that horrible skid I was on, and let's see if I can make it two in a row.
I believe in you.
I was going to say, if you wanted me to yell, we get a Civ Pro question, and nothing gets me more fired up than that. So Andrew and Thomas, listen up. A shop owner domiciled in State A sued a distributor in federal district court in State A for breach of contract. The shop owner sought $100,000 in damages for allegedly defective goods that the distributor had provided under the contract. The distributor is incorporated in State B with its principal place of business in State C.
I've already tuned out. Damn.
The distributor is incorporated in State B with its principal place of business in State C. The distributor brought in as a third-party defendant the wholesaler that had provided the goods to the distributor, alleging that the wholesaler had a duty to indemnify the distributor for any damages recovered by the shop owner. The wholesaler is incorporated in State B with its principal place of business in State A.
This might be one of those flip a four-sided coin ones.
And it continues. The wholesaler, right, has now been, you know, brought into the action, has asserted a $60,000 counterclaim against the distributor for payments of the good at issue, for the goods at issue. And the distributor has now moved to dismiss the counterclaim for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Should the motion to dismiss be granted? Love this. A, no, because the wholesalers and the distributor's principal places of business are diverse. B, no, because there is supplemental jurisdiction over the wholesaler's counterclaim. C, yes, because there is no diversity of citizenship between the distributor and the wholesaler. Or D, yes, because there is no diversity of citizenship between the shop owner and the wholesaler.
Oh, my God. You had to embarrass me like this in front of our friend, Andrew Seidel. I'll try to do my best to decode this for our other non-lawyer listeners. But we've got a shop owner, State A, sues distributor, federal district court in State A for breach of contract. The distributor is incorporated in State B with principal place of business in State C. So the shop owner is saying, hey, you gave me bad something, whatever it is, bad goods, defective goods. And then the distributor says, well, I should be indemnified against this because my wholesaler, I guess, who provided me the goods, I should be indemnified because it's their responsibility, essentially, I guess, for any damages. The wholesaler, so it says it brought, the distributor brought in as a third-party defendant the wholesaler. I don't really understand what that means, how you do that. Can you just do that? If I get sued, can I just be like, I know you're suing me, but I'm bringing Andrew Torres because I think he should be responsible for anything I say. So if we can do that, I guess I'll try to do that. The wholesaler is incorporated. Now, at this part, I don't know if this matters, but just in case, wholesaler is incorporated in State B with principal place of business today. Okay. So now we're just talking about the confusing part is we're now just talking about the wholesaler and the distributor, because it says the wholesaler has asserted a $60,000 counterclaim against the distributor for payment. So this part I do not understand. I can't wait to have some Andrews explain this to me, which is the shop owner suing the distributor, and the distributor is saying, I'm bringing in a defendant, which is the wholesaler, like bring like on their side kind or something. But then it says the wholesaler is doing a counterclaim against the distributor, which I don't know how you have a counterclaim against the person who's not suing you. Like, it's still the shop owner who's suing you. That's confusing to me. I'm sure it'll work itself out somehow. Counterclaim against the distributor, payment, blah, blah, blah. And the distributor has moved to dismiss the counterclaim for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. So the whole question rests on, I guess, the distributor dismissing the counterclaim that the wholesaler brought for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Is the trick going to be, because we're in federal district court, it's going to matter whether we've got the diversity jurisdiction kind of thing? Is that what it's going to be? So I guess if I'm looking at the wholesaler and the distributor, we'll go back to it here. The distributors in state B with principal place of business in state C, and it says the wholesaler is in state B with principal place of business in state A. That seems like it has enough diversity going on, although I can never remember the specific rules. Is that going to be what it rests on? Okay. So should the motion to dismiss, oh God, screw this question, Andrew. Should the motion to dismiss be granted? A, no, because the wholesalers and the distributors' principal places of business are diverse. That could be. Okay. So that at least tracks with the facts as I see them, because one is state principal place of business, state C, the other is state A. B, no, because there is supplemental jurisdiction over the wholesaler's counterclaim. That answer I take to be like, because the counterclaim arose as a result of the original claim, even if there's some sort of jurisdiction issue, it wouldn't matter because it's part of that original thing. That's kind of how I'm reading that, which if that's true, that's going to be really hard to pick which is the better answer between A and B. I'm actually not sure. I think I would lean toward A. For the no answers. Okay, so now let's go to the yes answer. So this is yes, the motion will be dismissed. It's C, yes, because there's no diversity of citizenship between the distributor and the wholesaler. So that is true. So I'm having a hard time remembering what matters between where it's incorporated. So I think that's saying because it's the distributor is incorporated in state B, the wholesaler is incorporated. So they're both incorporated in state B. And then the question is, because they have the different places business in state A versus state C. So that's I don't know. And then D, yes, because there's no diversity of citizenship between the shop owner and the wholesaler. Well, I'm going to go ahead and say D is the one I can get rid of. I hope. Well, God, maybe not because of the weird co-defendant thingy. This is a skip. The answer is skip the question. It's not worth the time.
It. Come back to it if you have time on it later. Yeah,
this is not worth the time of sorting through this.
Seriously, as Torres was reading it, I was like, this is what I would do on that one probably.
Yeah, you just skip. There's no reason to answer this. But because I've wasted all of our time, I might as well try to come up with an answer. This is really hard because right when I thought I could dismiss D, I could also see a weird situation in which, you know, because the original suit was involved the shop owner, but maybe I'll just try to, it's like that old thing, you know, when you're looking for your keys in the dark, you just look under the street lamp, not because they might be there, but because that's the only place you will find them if they are there, because you got the light. I'm going to say, go with my instinct and dismiss D because the shop owner is no longer involved in this counterclaim. So I don't care about that. That would make it easier to say C, yes. So that gives me an easier yes answer. I don't think I need to worry about the facts of why the money is being what. I think we're just worried about subject matter, jurisdiction-y, whatever. I think it's between A and B, actually. The two no answers. I think it's either okay because the places of business are diverse or because there is supplemental jurisdiction over the wholesaler's counterclaim. I think those are both plausible-ish. And so, like, which would be the better no answer? And I think I'll go ahead and say A, no, because the wholesalers and distributors' principal places of business are diverse. I have less than zero confidence in this answer, but I'm going with that. screw this question. We should have all skipped this. And I'm sorry to have wasted the listener's time. And I'm sorry to have wasted the Andrews's time. But no, you signed on for this. So I retract that apology. All right. Andrew Seidel, tell me what in the world is happening in this question.
I mean, this is, it's a jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, 1332 question, but really it's a 1367 question, I think. So I mean,
there's my mistake.
It's pretty clear that, right, that the original claim meets the 1332 jurisdiction. There's diversity, the amount in controversy is over 75,000. So there's a federal jurisdiction under 1332 over the original claim. Right. So then the question is, can the court look at this counterclaim with 1367 supplemental jurisdiction? And if I remember the language, it's is so related or something like that to the original claims. And I'm just going to go ahead and say that it is so related. It looks close enough for me. I don't remember this the test for so related. So, yeah, I'm going to go B.
Because the amount is less than 75,000, but
no, but that's why they're tricking you, because there's not 1332 over that second counterclaim because it's under.
That's what I'm saying. But
they can
since
still have 1367.
Related.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So that's supplemental 28 USC 1367. I think the court does have supplemental jurisdiction. So I'm going with that answer, which I think you said that was B.
Sometimes, though, we're both wrong, so you never know, but that sounds pretty well reasoned to me. But thanks for playing, Andrew Seidel. And Andrew, why don't you tell people how they can play along?
Yeah, if folks want to play along with this discussion of 28 USC 1367, I love, there's nothing I love better than when a lawyer who isn't me goes into a huge detailed discussion and cites to statutes only to like have somebody come along and be like, right, but it's this other thing. I'm not saying that that's the case here. Yeah. I am not. I'm just saying, feel free to guess either Thomas's answer A, Andrew Seidel's answer B, or maybe one of the yes answers. Who knows? And you know how to do that. Just share this episode out on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include one of those four fine guesses, and we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All right, Andrew Seidel, I can't wait to find out that you're right and also hear you yelling about separation of church and state on Tuesday. So we will see you all then.
He's not even a lawyer and he's kicking your ass.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media LLC. All rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community: Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.